I'm Michael Morris, a professor at Columbia University in the psychology department and the Graduate School of Business. I do behavioral science research, primarily in the field of cultural psychology. I'm going to share with you five bite-sized pieces of my book, Tribal. I hope that they provoke insights and pique your appetite. If nothing else, I hope I can show you that you belong to many tribes. The United States is a tribe. The New Economy is a tribe. And even the Next Big Idea Book Club is a tribe. Tribe can be defined as a large social network bound together by shared ideas. This is the original meaning of the Latin term tribe that I hope to reclaim. It describes a quintessential human experience of connection based on common understanding that is increasingly forgotten in organizations and campaigns to their detriment. Tribe and tribal shouldn't be dirty words. The human adaptations for connecting to groups are often portrayed in the media as our worst instincts because they can inflame conflicts. But they are equally our best instincts because they empower all the positive things that we can accomplish collectively. Tribal loyalties are the strongest of all human motivations. Great leaders have always figured out ways to harness them, to galvanize commitment, forge coalitions, and steer change. Nowadays, we have a behavioral science understanding of tribal instincts, and I've drawn on this to build a playbook for leveraging them constructively. To be sure, tribal instincts have contributed to some of the world's most pressing problems, but they can also be part of the solution. Bite number one. Tribal instincts are what made us human in the first place. I grew up thinking of group-oriented motivations like conformity, status-seeking, and nostalgia as bugs in the system of an otherwise intelligent species. But after decades as a behavioral scientist, I've come to understand that they are not bugs, but features. These group impulses may be irrational at times, but they are intrinsic parts of the evolved psychology that is the secret superpower of our species. Our group-oriented motivations are rooted in the adaptations that evolved in the Stone Age to promote the sharing of ideas in groups. These culture-creating impulses enabled the formation of larger and more collaborative communities. Even strangers could be trusted if they shared your greeting rituals, shared your social frameworks, and shared your ideals. The radius of trust expanded beyond the ties of kith and kin to broader networks of groups. Behavioral scientists used to debate nature versus nurture, but in the past decade, they've concluded that human nature is nurture. We are the animal wired to encode the patterns of the communities that nurture us, and then to enact those patterns. Recent discoveries about our social brains and about our forebears' social lives have upended the well-worn 20th century narrative about the human journey, that our forebears were hardly more social than chimpanzees, that they knew only tiny bands of fellow foragers until the agricultural revolution gave rise to scale, surplus, and symbolic activities like building the Stonehenge temples. We now know that temple building and other ritual collaborations long preceded agriculture. We now know that clan-level cooperation and hunts began hundreds of thousands of years ago. We now know that early cultural evolution of human groups has shaped our species' genetic evolution. These revolutions have inspired nothing less than a new origin story for our species, one that places tribes and tribal instincts at the center of the plot. Bite number two. Three basic tribal instincts still shape us today. Three waves of group psychology evolved over the course of the Stone Age. The peer instinct to imitate and mesh with those around us, the hero instinct to emulate the respected contributors in the community, and the ancestor instinct to perpetuate the ways of prior generations. Each instinct made our forebears more cultural and more collaborative. First, we became capable of coordinating to hunt and gather based on shared goals. Then we also became able to cooperate in the stronger sense of making sacrifices to help the group. Finally, we also became able to conserve the knowledge of prior generations rather than losing it. Once all three instincts were in place, the real magic of tribal living started. Groups didn't need to reinvent the wheel every generation. innovations could build beyond past expertise. Innovations that worked would get emulated and then propagated. The result was cumulative cultural evolution. Cultures grew richer and more relevant over time. Individuals became progressively more capable because they could access this growing legacy of shared knowledge. These three systems still operate in our group psychology today. First, our sideways glances at classmates, coworkers, and neighbors, our resulting knowledge of what's normal in these groups, and the comfort we feel in conforming to it, all this reflects the peer instinct. It limits our independent thinking sometimes, but it's why we can meld minds and mesh actions with in-group members so readily, getting on the same page and working as a united front. Next, our upward peaks into the lives of CEOs, MVPs, and rock stars, our yearning for their renown, and our penchant for taking on the quirks that we observe. All this evinces the hero instinct. It's why we get pulled in by clickbait about what quarterbacks eat for breakfast or by human interest articles about whether the president wears boxers or briefs. But it's also why successful innovations get noticed and adopted. Finally, the ancestor instinct lingers in our backward-looking curiosity about past generations, our fascination with founders, histories, and antiques, and our ache to maintain traditions and the deep meaning, connection, and existential balm that we find in them. Our compulsion to carry forward tribal traditions is why some myths and rituals can persist across centuries. But it's also why defense of traditions can stir up moral absolutism and extremist actions. Our needs for belonging, standing, and continuity work together to motivate us to engage with and enact the patterns of our culture. Bite number three. Cultures are manageable. We can cue cultures through tribal triggers. It's a myth that the cultural landscape is unchanging and unchangeable. The cultural patterns of individuals and groups fluctuate from one setting to the next. The underlying reason for this mutability is multiplicity. We pick up new cultural identities and codes with each new community that nurtures us. Religions, professions, vocations, avocations, and so forth. As Walt Whitman put it, "I am large, I contain multitudes." Because the imperatives of different identities contradict, our cultural codes cannot be always on. They take turns, activating in response to situational cues. This situational triggering is familiar in the linguistic code switching of politicians like Barack Obama, who speak in a different dialect depending on the audience they face. It's a reflexive response to signs of a tribe that they belong to, like people's faces or their attire. My research has found that the switching in response to triggers runs much deeper than habits of communication. There are also switches in habits of mind, in cognitive biases that differ across cultures. Situational triggers provide an important lever to managers who strive to summon identities and habits that help an endeavor and not those that hinder it. Increasingly, urban schools require uniforms to bring out student identities instead of street clothes that may trigger distracting and divisive identities, rich versus poor or Crips versus Bloods. In the corporate world, the current return to office push comes in part from the realization that during work from home, individual productivity increased, but collective productivity decreased. In particular, coordination decreased. A common workplace surrounds employees with cues that make the organizational culture salient. These conventions stay top of mind for those at the office and channel decision-making in consistent directions. However, when managers want creative and new ideas, they hold retreats off-site so that the firm's conventions are not constraining employees' thoughts. While the peer codes that carry cultural habits are triggered by tribe mates or any signs of them, the hero codes that carry ideals and the ancestor codes that carry traditions activate in response to more specific experiences. Hero codes activate in response to tribal symbols, the iconic images or phrases or songs that a community uses to stand for itself. In the past, crusaders were recruited to sacrifice their comfort by the Christian symbol of the cross. Soldiers followed the flags of their nations into battle. Today, mascots send sports fans into a frenzy, and corporate mottos inspire employees to give their all. Ancestor codes are triggered by the symbolic experience of ceremonies, group events that involve references to history and synchrony. For example, political rallies that involve speeches about past fights, marching in unison, and chanting slogans raise feelings of obligation to tribal traditions. Evoking cultural strengths and loyalties requires setting the stage, rigging an environment with the needed triggers. Politicians, coaches, and CEOs know that cultural habits surface in particular settings, cultural ideals can be stoked by symbols, and cultural traditions can be summoned by ceremonies. Bite number four. Cultures are malleable. You can lead change through sending tribal signals. The three tribal instincts correspond to different ways that people map their community. Peer instinct attention to what's prevalent, hero instinct interest in what's prestigious, and ancestor instinct curiosity about what's precedented. These three kinds of social information mold people's cultural codes, and they are also the key to remolding these codes, to altering cultures. Changemakers who want to shift a cultural norm create prevalence signals. For example, when Kodak wanted to promote amateur photography, they ran ubiquitous ads with Kodak girls snapping photos on their travels, but they also gave away cameras to schools and clubs. They launched magazines featuring snapshot contests. By making it appear prevalent, Kodak lured more and more consumers to try amateur photography, setting off a cycle of changed practices and changed perceptions that ultimately created a new normal. Changemakers who want to shift a cultural ideal do so through prestige signals. To change people's family planning behaviors, public health agencies have found fact-based programs to be less effective than soap operas with heroes or heroines that exemplify the desired behavior. Even though fictional characters, they are still figures of prestige who serve as role models that reshape people's life goals. Changemakers who want to forge a cultural tradition do so through precedent signals. When Abraham Lincoln was inaugurated in 1860, with seven states already seceded and civil war mounting, he promised the despairing nation that the mystic chords of memory will yet swell the chorus of the Union. In 1863, shortly before referencing the Founding Fathers in his more famous Gettysburg Address, Lincoln issued a proclamation asking Americans to set aside the last Thursday of November as a Thanksgiving holiday, referencing the precedent of Puritan Thanksgiving celebrations and of George Washington's one-time giving of thanks after the Revolutionary War. The public accepted the new holiday as an established custom and soon embraced it as a sacred institution, coming to think of it as an unbroken tradition from the pilgrims to the present. This ritual meal and reflection on common ancestors helped heal the riven nation in the years and decades that followed the Civil War. Because cultural codes are perceptions that get updated based on experiences, we can all be change makers. We don't just internalize signals from the peers, heroes, and ancestors of our tribes. We also send signals, whether intentionally or not. You will be a peer, a hero, and an ancestor to others, so your words and actions can shape the culture. If you understand the right signals, you can sway conceptions of what is normal, what is normative, and what is traditional in the culture. Bite number five. Don't despair. We are not fated to toxic tribalism. In recent times, the competition between Democrats and Republicans has verged into dysfunctional conflict. Increasingly, our two-party system looks like a standoff between polarized red and blue tribes. Political journalists have tried to make sense of these disturbing developments by positing that an innate animus for outsiders has reawakened in our politics, blurring our view of reality and blocking communication with the other side. These pundits express despair as the genie is out of the bottle and there's no way to get it back inside again. This trope of toxic tribalism makes for riveting articles, but not for very helpful policies. It's also inaccurate, not a picture of tribal instincts that science would recognize. The human-specific social adaptations are instincts for solidarity, not for hostility. They are primarily us instincts, not them instincts. In-group conformity, generosity, and traditionalism can indirectly contribute to conflict, but it's wrong to think that our political divides start from hostility. A large part of political tribalism comes from our affinity and conformity to our in-groups, the peer instinct motivation to mesh. Over the past two generations, this yearning for agreement has pushed many people toward living in partisan communities and listening to partisan news sources. In these ideologically inbred environments, which it helped to create, this conformist instinct has become dangerous. We've come to live in different realities, each party with its own falsehoods, whether about Haitians consuming pets or about J.D. Vance's bond with his couch. The conformist processing happens automatically, so we are not aware of it. We think our political beliefs are accurate reflections of reality, hence we are baffled that the other side doesn't agree with them. So we start to doubt their sincerity or even their cognitive acuity. The fear and loathing flows from these attributions. Once we understand that political tribalism arises from unchecked peer instinct processing, we can use what we know about triggers and signals to manage the influence of partisan frames in the short term and to mold people's beliefs over the longer term. I can't get into the details here without biting off more than I can chew, but I promise that the book explains how you can avoid triggers of partisan frames so they don't constantly control your thinking, and how you can contribute to signals that move people to more common views of facts so that they don't reject each other as insincere or insane. The book looks at racial conflicts and religious conflicts too, suggesting that they also don't arise from a toxic instinct of hate, but from the familiar tribal instincts that we know how to manage. Thanks for listening. I hope these bites were not too big to swallow. I hope that you enjoy the book.